This is a production of Cornell University.
GPSA reading, October 5th, 2009.
So that's number one. Number two, expenditure reductions should be greatest in administrative operation. Greatest in administrative operation. Consonant with appropriate processes and risk management, and recognizing that those operations occur across the university, colleges, and central units, and might be viewed holistically. So I'm going to work very hard to reduce expenditures first and to raise the same administrative areas. So we've given up two positions in my office. One of them is canceled the search for that position. And the other one was one where the person decided to take the retirement incentive, and we decided not to fill that position. So starting with my office and working through the provost's office and the administrative offices, we'll do our best to reduce administrative expenditures. And we'll see how successful that is we're working on it, especially with our team consultants. Three, all units across the university will contribute to reducing the structural financial deficit of the university. So that means that all colleges and all units of the university, including the students' office and everyone, will be expected to participate in expenditure reduction so that we can all try to help reduce the deficit and balance the budget. Four, final decision, that is to say, based on recommendations we made by the president and provost, after broad and transparent consultation, with special consideration of the opinions of those most conversant with the areas under review. So I'm here for two reasons today. One is that I come very often in GPSA, but the other reason is that we're going through a series of open forums. We've had two of the staff, one of the faculty, one of the students, other student work coming up. And it's very important that we get that consultation. And also, we're working specifically to get the opinions of those most close to the areas that they know the most about. To put that a different way, the reason the provost wants graduate professional students and undergraduates to advise directly to him is because nobody knows more about the student experience than current students. And then finally, number five, decisions should be made as much as possible with the intention of optimizing the quality and value of colleges, individual units, and the entire university. But if a conflict exists, it should be decided in favor of the greater university. And I'm going to talk about that because this is the biggest departure for Cornell. All of these early excellent research universities became excellent because of excellence in individual areas. It's not the president's office that makes university excellent, but the community program that makes office excellent. It's the fact that you're working in a lab, you're working in a studio, you're working in some area, a department, college, a field, graduate field, and the excellence in that field is what makes your experience excellent. So we're going to try very hard to make decisions that optimize quality in those units. But if we run into an issue where we have to choose between autonomy of college and the welfare of the whole university, we're going to choose the welfare of the whole university. And so, for example, if there's an administrative procedure where we can save a lot of money by causing everyone to do something in a more uniform fashion, even though it causes some inconvenience out of local units, and we're going to do it anyway because we think that bringing the money back in that will allow us to be better for everything from faculty to improving the retention of student financial aid. And the last thing I want to mention that's not on this is that my highest priority in student financial aid has been, and much of that, of course, is related to undergraduate student financial aid because the help of getting through graduate professional education has a different set of sources, a lot of problems, a different set of sources than undergraduate education. And we have shown our commitment to that regularly by actually taking money out of the university endowment for undergraduate financial aid. Starting last year, a very substantial amount of money out of the endowment. So we will continue to work very hard on the support of both domestic and international students, focusing predominantly on undergraduates, but also graduate professional students as a number one priority that won't be affected by these decisions. So that's what I want to share with you, and I'm glad to take questions, whatever you prefer, how you prefer to do it.
Pick your own question.
So my name is Renaldo Sai. I'm actually a representative from the Underground Group Assembly. One of my questions is based on, I guess, the mix of two and four. And I talked about transparency and then reducing administrative costs. And I saw a piece in the paper about reducing administrative costs by a rental of, I think it was $90 million by 2015. So, I mean, I think you touched on it a little bit when you talked about, like shrinking the size of your office and eliminating positions. But, like, where is the grand total of some of this $90 million coming from?
Well, the expenditure reductions for any organization, it's very personnel intensive, like university, where about $2 out of every $3 we spend on salaries and compensation benefits. And the most direct way to reduce expenditures is to reduce workforce size. And we tried not to do that as a number one mover here. That's the reason that we have a retirement program, so that people could choose with dignity and with some financial security to retire as opposed to being laid off against the whole And we're trying very hard to find what I'm calling non-personnel. So my dear personnel, to find non-personnel ways of saving money. So on procurement, once again, if we found a way to purchase a category of goods at a discount based on the combined strength of the purchasing of many, many departments across the university, and the purchasing was done on general university funds, and we saved, several percent of those funds, the net savings of the university that does not involve layoffs for personnel actions. See what I'm saying? And so I'm focusing on non-personnel actions. And there's a whole list of them. We're going to start rolling them out as quickly as we're ready to talk about them, but as quickly as we know what we're talking about, and have made a decision to pursue them. And one thing we'll be hearing about pretty soon is procurement. Now, the estimate of $90 million came from our consultants from Bain. Based on estimates, after doing many, many, many consultations with many kinds of organizations, corporate organizations, and non-profits, universities, or public and private, their estimation of what we might actually do, given that there may be some suggestions they have that just wouldn't fit our sort of environment here and our ethos. And so that's a combination of non-personnel actions like procurement reduction, and some reduction in workforce. And that reduction in workforce, as I just mentioned to you by the example in my office, can come by a variety of ways. Removing a position that was vacant doesn't lay anybody off. It does cause the remaining staff at the airport harder because you still have a lot of work to do. There's fewer people doing the work. It also will be a discussion that we'll try to engage the students and faculty and staff in to decide if there are certain kinds of things at the university that we just don't need to be doing. I'm not talking about we need to be doing a certain kind of research. I mean, there are certain other kinds of support functions that we don't need to be doing at the university. And those are a long, long list of things that we're studying through right now, that they need to be sort of going on. But it's a combination of non-personnel and personnel kinds of reductions. My intention is to get at least half of the money that we need out of non-personnel uses. In other words, to try to emphasize actions that retain people's jobs. And how successful we will be at that will depend on just two factors. One is the robustness of the idea that we bring forward, and the second is the willingness of the campus to change the way you do things in order to allow us to reduce the expenditure. And, it's a campus where campuses are organizations where the president really doesn't tell everybody what to do. We have to somehow come together and work together and make these things happen. The most important tool I have is persuasion. And I'm going to try to persuade the campus to participate in these in a wholehearted way because it will allow us to reduce expenditures without reducing the workforce of the university to an excessive degree. Questions?
Well, yeah, are there any other questions? And they could be related to the reimagining Cornell or anything
or
else,
anything like, yeah.
Because this is our moment to consult that with the president.
I understand I read your article in the Daily Sun about your daily schedule, and I think you're making a heroic effort on the short-term budget issues, and I really appreciate that. I have a concern from this presentation. As a graduate student representative, I think that a lot of us came to Cornell because of the excellence in research that this university has achieved.
Yep.
And you mentioned the shift in priorities to universities at the expense of units, potentially. You also mentioned your priority on undergraduate financial aid. As a graduate student, neither of those visions would attract me to come here as a senior research university. A question that arises to me from that is, how do you develop and how do you see the university developing a vision of where we want to be in 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
Right now we're doing a short-term financial crisis response. But how does the university community develop the vision of what we want to be leaders in?
Yeah, this is a terrific question. And let me try to clarify something and refocus. You were quite emphasized fairly enough, so I apologize. Academic excellence is the number one thing, the number one point, and that includes curriculum, research, scholarship, creative activity. So the number one thing we're optimized for is academic excellence. The Bain engagement has nothing in terms of administrative procedures, has anything to do with except to help push money toward outcomes and faculty recruitment and retention and facilities to support for curriculum and scholarship. When I talk at the bottom about decisions made as policy and pension optimizing quality, value, et cetera, but if the conflict exists that should be decided to find a greater university, this is what I'm talking about. I'm talking predominantly about administrative decisions. So for example, if we had eight function tests, and I'm talking about either research or whatever, but support function tests, and every single college had advanced support function college, and we could conceive of a way of having fewer than 14 of those functions, like five or one, and it would save us money. And college thinks, well, it would be very inconvenient for us to have to go to a single source, but it would save us money and allow us to put that in the back of the academic mission. We're going to do it that way. So that's what I'm talking about. When you decide where to come for graduate school, I'm going to be very presumptuous to give you. I'm going to think that it's based more than anything else on the quality of faculty and the strength of the areas that you want to study. Number one. Number two, the overall reputation of the place, what you would agree that we were. Number three, the quality of the people out in the field from that university so that the path was trodden for you, the people in discipline. Hence, we trained at Cornell, got a degree at Cornell, ended up with jobs that you've done fabulous, and we're going to think, well, if you have got a degree at Cornell, you probably need to be fabulous as well. We're going to optimize for all those things. Those are the things that we're trying to protect. And the reason that number two says expenditure reduction should be based on administrative operations is I think it's up to me as a bureaucrat, as a historian, to reduce the cost of the bureaucracy of the university in order to put things back on the right. It's important also, I know you know about this, I don't need to lecture you about it, but everybody's looking at this. If you look on the Yale website, Stanford websites for all the really excellent top universities, you'll see messages from their presidents that look uncannily similar to the messages that I'm sending out because we're in the same boat. Budgets are being cut, faculty hiring is slowing down, construction projects are being slowed down and put on hold totally. And so what we're trying to do is find the smartest possible way of bringing us out of this. And the last question you asked, how do you know we're going to be in 20 years? That's the point of the strategic planning process. And the reason.
Slide on that.
Yes, thank you. And the reason for the provost asking to have a direct advisory body from the GPSA, a direct advisory body from SA, is in order to have you speak your mind on what the university should look like going forward. So it's exactly what he's doing right now. And I urge you to consider, of course, obviously, the job is totally up to you. I urge you to consider having the provost come and meet with you at some point. or provost representatives, because that's the office in which it is going to drive the whole strategic planning process, which would be terrific. At least for you to think about having that kind of contact and be prepared on this schedule. There's a question here.
I had a quick question on TA shifts in general. I heard there's a 25% reduction in graduate colleges for the TA shifts and TA funding. And this has been compounded by the fact that a lot of some of the professors I know have lost some of their grants, so they can't find students in their labs or in their research environments themselves. And so is there any plan to potentially attract more students by providing the TA?
I can't give you a direct answer about the TA shift. I just don't know. I'm not trying to avoid it. I'm just not important. I apologize. And I'll ask you since if I need that. I'm going to just directly send it to the leader. On the issue of grants and so on, actually, university-wide grants are up, and the university has been very, very, very successful in this stimulus package President Obama's ARRA. I don't know the exact number, but it's something on the order of magnitude of $90 to $100 so far. The vast majority of this campus. There's actually a website that you can see following along. Now, that just means overall the university is doing well in competition. But even in the steady state, even in times where the federal government has been much more flush than it is now, individual grants and contracts do fail. And the labs are run based on the assumption of continued recurring competitive renewal funding. And so I know that there are some procedures in place to help bridge between grants, but I'm not up on the details or about the TA shifts. This was about RA shifts. And so I'll ask him if you can talk about that. I'm sorry, can you just interrupt?
Are there any other questions? Yes.
Sort of a question about some of the law school and professional side of it.
Yeah.
I know sometimes it's difficult because obviously even in this group here, most people are from the graduate side and the professional side. How does the vision for reimagining Cornell handle the professional school? Is there more autonomy given to the law school and the business school? At least from the constituents that I talk to at the law school, we obviously pay a different amount, and the sources of our financial aid are much fewer in terms of obviously we don't have THS or any of those options. How is input from the law school taken?
Yeah, so this is a very important question. And please remember, my full academic career is in the professional school, medical school, secondary engineering. So I'm very, very, very cognizant of this issue. First of all, every dean, including law, JGSN, and so on, every dean is involved in these discussions, every single one. Every single college was submitting a task force report on how it intends to deal in an austere environment. Last year, when it came time to make decisions on some initial, unfortunately, across-the-board budget cuts that are active in this year that we're in now, some arguments were made, understandably, that the sources of funding were different. Was it fair or unfair to ask everybody to participate? And I decided, if you go back to the earlier slide, that all units would contribute to reducing the structural deficit. So anything across the board is not done strategically, you know. It's not done in a way that carefully looks at those differences. And the first thing we did was across the board, and I can make no apology for that because the gaping difference between revenues and expenditures is so huge. But going forward, all the deans will have very significant input into this, and it will be up to your organization to decide who would be on the group to advise the provost. I'm assuming that the same power of that office would be the one to interact with the elected leadership of GPSA to decide. But it's critical from my perspective that undergraduates, graduates, and professional students, as well as faculty, every college and including medical school, be involved in this. Because as the gentleman in that raised, we are going to be trying to look forward for a long period of time. But just to make sure that we don't think this is something completely, totally radically different, it's not. The New Life Sciences Initiative that resulted in so many changes on campus over the last 10 years, including Wild Hall and so on, is based on a focused planning effort in one area. The West Campus was based on a focused planning area in terms of undergraduate living learning communities. So the university here has very, very good track record of coming together and planning something going forward. The difference now is that we're facing something unlike anything that's ever happened in our lifetimes, in our professional lifetimes, even geezers and old as I am. And so this planning just has to be more widespread so that we are looking ahead. 20 years is a scary length of time, but I would like to see us for, you know, 5 to 10 years out to think of the answer. There absolutely has to be.
Are there any other questions?
I have just one quick question. So I understand that my name is Ashley.
And just, sorry, can I just say for keeping time in mind, we have about 5 minutes, so if we could just have sort of quick 30 to 1 second to 1 minute answers.
So obviously we understand that there's immediate actions after the changes that are really drastic, but are there any plans that some of these changes might be reversed so that they're just short term and then they revert back to status quo, or are they all going to be long-term
ones?
These changes are imposed.
I'll do my best. Some questions can answer in 30 seconds, so I'm forgetting. I was working for Ashley. This is a hugely complicated question. Things that I personally think we should just do differently than that is here. Why would we ever go back if we could save money every year? It seems a little bit odd. Things where there are short-term efforts have to be reversed. For example, the slowness of faculty hiring. Obviously, we can't sustain that in a university. No raises in 1 year. You can't sustain. People won't work without raises. So they enter this company.
Great. Thank you. That's great. Stephen, how about you?
So, just in regard to the third point up there.
Yeah.
Now, I imagine that policy was instituted in the faculty from the university. But any consideration to use own doing that policy may entirely enact this result. Because some departments say when the study tests were called for, we're in a position where the number of faculty is much lower than it had been the year past because of certain pressure, and asking those departments to then make further steps would be very difficult because it results in even more drastic faculty reductions. So is there any consideration
this doesn't say that all units will contribute equally to reducing. It does not say that. The first year it was done that way because we had it at the start, and I got to be very honest with you, I have never seen an organization take a 5% growth and stuff. Never. Even departments that are up against it and so on and so forth, 5% is a relatively small number. There's a lot of things you can do to reduce expenses. We are definitely not going to apply, you know, one size fits all things going forward. That's the reason for all the planning, plenty of students involved, and so on and so forth. And also, in this one here, number 4, we said special consideration of the opinions of those most conversant with the areas under review. So there has to be local input. The trick is, how can we get this input and organize it quickly enough to affect decisions and begin to turn the ship in the right direction? But you're raising a really critically important point. The complaint factor, even if it's most difficult for all of us in American higher ed, I mean, I spent a lot of time, you know, talking to peers around the country, a lot of times, is that none of us have ever seen conditions quite as austere, like the whole country has seen anything like this since the Great Depression. These are really, really tough times. So what we have to do is find a balance where we agree on what our vision is going forward, and then we pursue it in the most strategic and fair way that you're talking about. So thank you very much.
Okay, and I'd like to follow up with my own question.
Please.
Just sort of considering, you know, how people have asked about the short-term and long-term, considering all the sustainability efforts on campus, how are you planning on streamlining that in with this? Do you see that as an opportunity to sort of bring that forward to
a
the
big
forefront?
Opportunity. We have, since all the crisis started, we brought forward to the board, to the executive committee of, to the Golden Properties Committee approval of the campus climate action plan. We're bringing that up for ratification by the full board in a couple of weeks. We are continuing our plans to get this done. There are some areas where sustainability efforts could actually help us reduce expenses by a judicious renovation of buildings and a lower energy cost. And so the question in all of these areas where investing money would not only do the right thing, but which is enough reason to do something, but also, you know, result in future savings, has to do with liquidity. It has to do with where do you get the money to invest in order to get this return on investment. In order to have some liquidity, the university did two things over the last year. One is that about a year ago, the investment committee and the investment office began to change the allocation of assets in our endowment to have some assets that were more easily accessible to cash. Mm-hmm. And secondly, and I know you know, so forgetting to remind you, we sold $500 million of taxable funds in order to increase liquidity in the university. So what we're trying to do in a smart way that takes into account forward planning and so on is to think about important societal and other goals that we want to hit and how they can converge with expenditures that will eventually result in savings. I'll give you another example very, very quickly in addition to sustainability. On the procurement administrative side, one of the things you have to do is have really excellent administrative computer systems, software systems, to keep track of things. We may have to invest money in systems in order to gain savings in the long term. But sustainability is a great example of that.
And how about with the management of the land grant? I know, of course. One more question. Well, people are... Okay, one of the major things that I think on campus is the management of the land grant institutions. And, from provost, speaking to provost, I've heard that there's some redundancy in departments. Is that something that's going to be looked at in this?
Yes, but I want to make a really important point. The dangerous thing to do in the university setting where the excellence comes from individual units is to have one person at the top say, we're going to lop off all these expertise and so on. We're not going to do that. We're going to get faculty, staff, and student input, and faculty especially work at that. So it has to be done. It has to be considered very, very carefully. It cannot be decided top down.
Okay.
President
Thank
Swartz,
you.
I want to thank you on all of our behalf because to join me in thanking President Swartz for his time. President Swartz, if there's any way that any of the students want to contact you with a further question,
thank you so much.
Thank you very much, President.
Okay, the next presentation will actually be by Gina Ryan. We'd like to welcome her here. And yes, it's about the university accreditation process.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for letting me speak to you tonight about the accreditation process that is currently going on at the university. Thank you, Dean Hubble, for joining me today. He's going to field any questions because he has all the background information. It's really in line with what President Swartz just discussed with us. The accreditation process is yet another review that is the university is undergoing, and it really allows us to really look at looking at the mission of the university, how well the university is adhering to that, and is there any way that we can streamline some of these programs without cutting into these programs. So, just briefly, accreditation is a process through which this is a self-examination process a little nervous tonight. All right, sorry to get here. Cornell has been accredited through the Middle States Commission on Higher Education since 1921. The Middle States Commission is the arm of this higher organization that is responsible for accrediting a lot of the educational programs in the northeastern region. It's a 10-year process, or it comes up every 10 years, and ours is coming up in a couple of years. Of a Federal funding and financial aid is tied to this accreditation status. There are two distinct accreditation processes that go on in the university. One is for specialized and professional programs, and then you have a university-wide process. And both, they call it rather similar process, but they are distinct. So this process that happens every 10 years, and it's composed of two primary parts. You have the internal in-depth review by the institution that culminates in a self-study report, and then you have an external part which is done by a visiting team that's comprised of members of faculty and administrative personnel from other institutions. So it's up to Cornell to demonstrate that it's meeting the standards that are outlined by the Middle States Commission, and they will put together the self-study report. Then the external review team will, based on this report, visit the campus and evaluate the university, and then make its recommendation to Middle States for our accreditation. This whole process is going to be overseen by the steering committee, and then they'll be tasked with the organizational issues, and then overseeing the working groups. And the working groups will actually go out and do the investigative work. You go out and evaluate programs and documents and policies, conduct interviews. Put together the report, send it back to the steering committee, which will then be in charge of actually drafting the final study document to submit to the Middle States Commission. So that self-study will demonstrate, the object of that self-study will be demonstrating Cornell's meeting each of the question standards, which I'll talk about in a moment. So the self-study is going to be about a 200-page narrative, which basically touching on the university is not that much. So this is where the visit by the team is really going to come into play. There'll be a chance for that one-on-one dialogue to really address some of the more complex issues that just aren't really apparent in the self-study. And so, any person in any study within one of the universities, we have, all these independent colleges and programs are acting autonomously, yet, coming together within one university and how all of this is kind of playing out. And so the goal of this self-study is to really see how we can, take advantage of, the individualness of each of these programs, and still, maintain the university. And so then all of this is going to be due to Middle States in beginning of 2011. So our steering committee is composed of a number of deans of faculty. So it basically covers the academic and administrative area of the university. We have Alan Saya, Matthews, Dean of Human Ecology, Kent Hubble, Dean of Students, Bill Fry, Dean of Faculty, Barbara Nook, Associate Dean of Cals, Susan Murphy, which is the VP of Student Academic Services, Paul Streeter, VP of Budget and Planning, Marilyn Parkberg, who's Associate Director of Institutional Research, Christian Walker, also VP of Institutional Research, Nikhil Kumar, which is the undergrad representative, myself, and David Hajar, who she is with Weill Gundy College. Then we have six working groups, and so these are the 14 standards were held into six main areas that fall under institutional stewardship, which is chaired by Kathy Ruffman. Rasmussen, Institutional Science. We have integrity, governance, and administration. which is overseen by Charles Volta from Neurobio faculty, Amy Villarreal between theater and film, and Student Admissions and Support, overseen by Craig Adler, also Neurobio, and Educational Offerings, overseen by Laura Brown in English, and Assessment of Student Learning, is being overseen by Dave Green in Computer Science. So this is our Bible. This is the Characteristics of Excellence in Higher Education. This is the booklet that describes the 14 standards defined by the Middle States Commission. And you can see here, it covers pretty much every aspect of the university. Institutional stewardship covers missions, goals, objectives, planning, resource allocation, institutional renewal, institutional resources, and assessment. Another working group is going to be covering leadership and governance, administration, and integrity, looking at ethics. We have another working group looking at student admissions, student support services, one looking at faculty, separate one looking at educational offerings, general education, related educational activities, and then finally assessment of student learning. So the timeline, so we have about 2 years here. The self-study plan has already been worked out. Working groups have been formed and are well on their way. From these committees, you might have been visited by some of these subcommittees. And so they have their final draft due to the steering committee in the spring. And from that, the steering committee is going to compile all of that information and put forth a first draft of the self-study over the summer, and then in the fall begin to involve the community, the campus and other communities, and get feedback on that. And then that final draft is going to be submitted to the Middle States Commission in March 2011. And then we'll have our external evaluation by the team in May, followed by an actual, we'll be notifying in the fall of 2011 of our accreditation status. So with that is we have a website up for the accreditation. Plenty of information there. So that's all I want to know.
Thank you so much. Thank you. About time for one or two questions. Does anyone like to? Does anyone have a question for Gina? Yes.
I think one of the most important questions I noticed in the self-study design plan document, and probably the most important question for this group here, is was asking how well is the university implementing and prioritizing the Dragon Community Initiative, and I was hoping you could just speak to that. If there's any has there been any preliminary findings, preliminary discussions as to how to best answer that question, and what have you found so far?
I'm not sure if anybody can speak.
I'd have to refer to the committee that would be involved in that. I don't know the answer. But as I understand it, the GPSA will revisit the GCI this year, if I'm not mistaken, in which case we would want to take forward your assessment of where we have been and what we've achieved and what we have to look forward to in the future and incorporate that into the document.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, so next on the agenda, we are going to have presentations and discussions about the activity fee. Dave is going to go ahead and provide a 2-minute explanation about that.
Okay, I'm giving an abbreviated presentation. 2 minutes, I'm going to give you a quick overview on what the Appropriations Committee has been up to. Step one, we have a committee. Present is Asha, Tom Balser, speaking of the original, and Stephen Choi. Anita Zhu is currently out of the country, but she is working with us. Just a quick timeline on what we've been up to. So obviously we have a committee established. All the applications have been read and reviewed by our committee. We met last week to discuss, you know, what's the information in the application, what are some of the questions that we had that were generated by reading applications. and what are some of the questions that we just want to answer in general. Overall, the applications were pretty good. But one thing that we did notice was there was varying levels of how the applications addressed two main questions that our community had. First one was, how does this group directly affect and improve lives of the graduate professional community? And two, if they're asking for an increase over the last filing funding, what is the specific reason or a rationale for that increase? That said, these groups are going to present again Wednesday and Thursday to us. Given the time restrictions, you know, we're not going to get enough. You know, we don't have enough time to get into all the questions that we would really like to ask. So that's where those presentations come in. Hopefully answer those questions.
Dave, just for the audience, are those meetings public or are they not public? I mean, could, if we wanted to attend those to learn more about the groups, could we come?
Yes, I would ask that you let me know if you're going to advance because the room holds, it's just a space limitation on the room. So they hold about 30-35 rooms, depending on which room.
So we have the sheets up front with all the voting members' contact information. If you're interested in attending the meeting to learn more, if you hear these groups initially present tonight, please speak with Dave or send him an email afterwards.
And kind of on that note, you know, we're not going to get all the questions that you guys want to ask today, given that they're not previous answers. So if you do have questions, email them to me ASAP, and we'll be sure to incorporate those into the presentations and the presentations, and hopefully we can get those answers there. And then kind of, here's what we're looking for, or looking at here's a comparison of prior filing funding amounts to what has been requested this year.
And these numbers here is how much from each student activity fee that you pay each year goes to each individual group. You know, you pay $70, the Bursar takes it out of your, Bursar charges you automatically,
yep.
And you're paying, each student paying this much for each group.
So the PowerPoint will be sent to you later tonight, so don't worry if you're squinting to find how much one group is. So we'll email that to you later this evening and tomorrow so you can have a better sense of what the numbers are. And next advisory meeting, Dave's going to be leading us again with the activity fee, and hopefully overall the body could discuss the overall activity fee before it goes to a vote, to the voting body.
Do you have totals that we would expect? No, or is it 50%?
Sorry?
Is there a total that you would expect?
This is what they requested per student.
Per student.
So this is the total if we were to get all grant all the requested, the activity fee per year.
Can I ask what
else is there? Well, they're going to be presenting, so at that time, you can ask them yourself.
The first group that's scheduled to present is athletics. Is athletics here to present? Yeah. And you will have about 2-3 minutes time after they present to ask questions.
Well, thank you for allowing us to come and speak tonight. My name is Larry Quant. I work in the Department of Athletics and Physical Education. I oversee all the financial operations of the department. I have a couple colleagues with me. Gene Nyman oversees our ticket operations, and Jeff Hall oversees sales and marketing. So after I finish and we take questions, I'll be happy to answer all the easy ones, and I'll let Sam answer the hard questions. We are from the Department of Athletics and Physical Education. We have about a $28 million operation. We're part of the Division of Student and Academic Services. Of that $28 million, approximately two-thirds of that is self-funded, and we rely on the university for support for the remainder of our operations. In addition to intercollegiate athletics, we are also, we oversee intramurals, Cornell Outdoor Education, the physical education program, the Cornell Fitness Centers, as well as a lot of the facilities, the golf course, the tennis center, the bowling lanes. So we really touch most people just think of the intercollegiate athletics, but we really touch almost every student at one time or another during their time at Cornell through their involvement in any of those areas. So that's just a quick overview. I'll just go through our request real quickly. This is my first time here. I've not been here at Cornell that long, so I don't know all the history, but I do know that there's been a long history of a solid partnership between the department and the graduate and professional students. We're looking to maintain that, and pretty much along the same lines as what we currently have. What we're proposing is that we will provide a free Big Red Sports Pass for all graduate and professional students who are interested in signing up for one. This pass provides free admission to every game and event that we have, with the exception of men's ice hockey. So football, men's basketball, women's basketball, lacrosse, wrestling, any of the events that we charge admission for, with the exception of men's ice hockey, would be covered under this Big Red Sports Pass. And please note that this would not only cover the individual student, but also his or her spouse and children, if applicable. The other caveat is it does not cover postseason events. So if the lacrosse team has an NCAA tournament game here that we host, it does not apply that, because that's not our event. We're just running it for the NCAA. We don't keep the revenue. So the only two things it doesn't cover is men's ice hockey and postseason events in any sport. In addition, we would provide discounted men's ice hockey season tickets. Currently, we're providing 200 tickets at a price that's a $5 discount per game. So if there's 16 home games, which is a normal season, that's an $80 discount from the general public price. And it's possible that we may even have more than 200 tickets available, but it would be at least 200 each year. We would commit to no price increase on the hockey tickets through the term of this byline funding cycle. And the third thing that we would provide, which we currently do now, is just access to all of our facilities and programs for the graduate and professional student community. In return for that, what we're requesting is $7 per student per year, which is an increase of $1 from our current funding of $6. And we're really making that request, certainly understanding that money is tight everywhere, but for a couple of reasons. Number one, in looking at the history, the funding has been at $6 for at least the last 10 years. I couldn't find any history going back further than that. But for the 2000-2001 year, the funding was $6. So we think a $1 increase after 10 years is a reasonable request. In addition, what we're trying to do is become more consistent between the funding levels between the graduate and professional students and the undergraduate students. And our request to the undergraduate students is also $7 per person. In return for that increase, we would agree that we would not request a further increase, not only for this two-year period, but for the two-year period after that as well. So that is it in a nutshell. It's a fairly straightforward proposal, a straightforward arrangement that we have. So I guess we'll take any questions. Yes.
So, could you briefly explain why the dollar increase then?
Briefly explain it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think I it's in. Okay. Go ahead.
The $7, the increase of $1 to $7 actually raises the graduate fee up to the undergraduate fee. The undergraduates have been paying $7 for quite some time now, and the graduate students have always received all of the same benefits. In fact, they receive the additional spouse and child benefits. So, yeah, in essence, grads are getting a greater benefit, and we're just asking for the same dollar amount as the undergrads.
Okay, Rich, is that?
I have a general question about the, so you said that all the rooms will include the access to physical education facilities and programs at the student centers and stuff. So one of the concerns that I had, and I've heard from other graduate students in general, is that traffic and pressure case sequence are here pretty much throughout the year. And a lot of times you'll notice like spring break, fall break, or even sometimes during the summer, their hours are severely reduced, and it doesn't really fit into our schedule in terms of during the year, it's great to have things open a long time, but then during the summer or during fall break or spring break, you see like garden malls closed or houses closed, and a lot of these places are closed, and you feel like almost second-class business in terms of undergrads have a higher priority. So, would that be improved at least with the increase in $1?
Well, I think it's a hard issue because a lot of those facilities and those programs are heavily staffed by student workers. And so when they're not here, our labor force is gone. But we can certainly look into more, keeping it open more during those periods. But that's really not anything that we anticipated in this request. But we're happy to look at it.
Okay, one more question. I think, yep.
I'm wondering how, if at all, the proposed rate increase to $1 will affect the rate discharge of this membership. And I'll be director. I've been in institutions where the membership fee is included in the activity that this is, and there's also, pay for membership that's been brought on the street to the LID slash and discharge. I'm wondering how the proposed increase, if at all, affects.
For the fitness center? This would have no impact at all. So the price would not go up. In fact, it's a totally different analysis. It's totally unrelated.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
All right.
The next presentation is by Cornell Cinema. There's somebody here to represent you. Okay. Oh, there we go. You are coming up. Okay.
We actually didn't prepare a PowerPoint presentation, so we passed out a handout so you can sort of follow along with the points I'm going to make. My name is Mary Fessenden. I'm the director of Cornell Cinema, and this is Chris Riley, who's the manager. So we'll get right to it. Cornell Cinema has a national reputation as one of the best campus film exhibition programs in the country. Our primary mission is educational, to expose Ithaca audiences to a wide range of cinema, and as well as to alternative voices not usually heard through the mass media. Our secondary purpose is to provide affordable, second-run commercial film entertainment for the Cornell community. It's important to note that educational, artistic endeavors, by their very nature, are not commercial or self-supporting. They always require a subsidy to exist, and so it is with Cornell Cinema. Also, it's important to note that Cornell Cinema is fundamentally different from places like Cinemopolis, downtown, and the local multiplex, both in what we're trying to achieve and how we are structured. Now, onto what we do in a nutshell. We show about 275 different programs each year. We program films 7 nights a week, providing a nightly escape hatch for students. We screen foreign films from around the world, which is of a great service to Cornell's large international community. We premiere documentaries addressing a wide range of topics of interest to graduate students from fields across the campus, oftentimes with faculty intros and panel discussions. We have special guest presentations by visiting filmmakers and film scholars. We show films in conjunction with conferences and symposia. We host unusual live music film events, and we program historical and other thematic film series. How are graduate students directly involved with Cornell Cinema? We have a student advisory board. Currently, there are 6 graduate students serving on our board, and they come from a wide variety of fields: law, physics, computer science, engineering, hotel, city and regional planning, and English, illustrating Cornell Cinema's multidisciplinary appeal. There are graduate students who work for us in paid and volunteer positions. Graduate students introduce films for us. They participate in conferences and symposia with a film component. They participate in post-screening panel discussions. and graduate student organizations submit co-sponsorship proposals to Cornell Cinema, so their members benefit from the screenings that we do in response to those proposals. Overall attendance at Cornell Cinema. For the most recently completed year, our overall attendance was 30,000. We estimate that 20 to 25% of our audience is made up of graduate students from audience surveys that we've done. So that means between 6,000 and 7,500 tickets were sold to graduate students in fiscal year 08-09. But beyond attendance, there are benefits to graduate students that that really can't be captured by these attendance figures. Faculty members and students regularly tell us that Cornell Cinema is one of the reasons they don't feel as isolated as they otherwise would in such a small town as Ithaca. Even if they can't make it to all of the programs that they would like to, they say that Cornell Cinema's presence makes them feel much better about being here. And I think this goes towards this idea that Cornell Cinema actually helps attract and retain quality faculty and graduate students to Ithaca. The regularity of our programming, 7 nights a week, is unique, and it offers an outlet on any evening a graduate student needs a break, either to get away from the stresses of their studies or as an alternative to the bar scene. In addition, many of the films Cornell Cinema screens are relevant to graduate students' research and other teaching. So even if they actually can't attend a screening, they're actually able to learn about new films from our calendar, and that can be of use to them, even if they have to see it on DVD when it comes out later. And Cornell Cinema's ticket prices are particularly suited to graduate students' budget. So to summarize our funding request, at the end of this fiscal year, we will have been receiving $11 per graduate student for 4 consecutive years. Our request for a 75-cent per student increase is based on decreased funding from 4 key sources: our New York State Council on the Arts grant, the co-sponsorship funding from academic departments and programs we raise over the course of the year, our grant from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and the subsidy we received from the College of Arts and Sciences. All of these losses came to a total of over $15,000. A 75-cent per student increase from both the undergrads and graduate students will help plug this hole, although not entirely. If you've seen our projected budgets and our overall proposal, you can see that even with this increase, we are still anticipating deficits over the next 2 years, but we think we can keep them to a manageable level. Even with the increase that we're requesting, our overall GPSA byline funding will continue to cover just 13% of our overall operating costs.
Okay. Thank you so much. Okay, do we have questions? Go ahead.
Recently, Louis Trey presented a proposal to the undergraduate student assembly for a large, I think it was a flat screen television that could possibly use by Cornell Cinema to show movies on to use Cornell Cinema on the slope on the third sense, like outside on good days. And they were told by the undergraduate student assembly that in order to receive funding for this, they would have to receive contributions from other groups that would have access to the TV as well. Is this something that you guys would entertain? Because then, a very perishable thought that a 75-cent increase could justify.
I'm not totally sure I'm following you. You're saying whether Cornell Cinema would contribute money for
Is that something you know about personally? Is that something that Cornell Cinema would look at?
No. We do outdoor screenings in the summertime, and we use our own projection equipment, and we do the screenings on the terrace out here in Willis Street. And then the programming that we're doing during the year is primarily 35mm film prints, which still provide a better quality than DVD projection. And so the screenings need to happen inside. So we haven't been approached about this proposal, so this is the first time hearing about it.
Okay.
So if I remember correctly from the last time you presented 2 years ago, most of that money was for the expense of bringing in the film writer. Is that correct? The producer, director?
Well, you'd have to look at our overall budget to be able to sort of see how the money is spent. So it's spent on any number of different things. The whole operation, there are all sorts of costs involved with running the operation. I do have them in front of me. But if you want to get into those kinds of details, film rental, for instance, over the course of the year costs something like $65,000. And then we spend about $30,000 bringing in visiting filmmakers, live music events, you know, that sort of thing. There are advertising costs, there's office rental, theater rental. So there are any number of things that make the whole organization
and
possible.
Just one quick follow-up. When you say 20-25% of the audience, is that for all events or is it just the major picture?
Well, that's the you know, sort of the overall average, and so obviously it depends from film to film. So sometimes graduate students would make up a much larger percentage, and sometimes they make up a smaller percentage. But it's,
but this would encompass all events.
All the events we do. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Do we have time for one more question?
Sorry, I can't hear the question. The 20-25%. Well, it's based on sort of, you know, over the years we do audience surveys every few years, and so from the audience surveys we can sort of glean that amount. Because graduate students pay the same amount as undergraduates, we don't have separate ticket rolls, and so we can't tell specifically. So that's why we depend on the surveys. And then also just from being at events and actually kind of seeing who is in the audience, that gives us some indication as well. And so over the years, it's borne out that it's been about 20-25%.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
Sure.
The International Student Programming Board.
I'll be presenting on behalf of the International Student Program Board. Just to give some overview of the international community in Cornell, there are currently about 6,427 international students in Cornell, and that is approximately 33% of the total enrollment in Cornell. And then last year, there were about 240 international and cultural groups on campus. And ICB's role is to serve as an umbrella student organization for these international and cultural organizations in Cornell. And then in the past, we have funded about 27% of these international groups, and that came out to about 63 groups for the year. And just to give you some overview of what ICB do, so as I mentioned, ICB is an umbrella student organization to the international and cultural organizations in Cornell. And ICB provides funding as well as provides advice and support to students to help them plan for events. We help primarily international and cultural groups to help plan events, help them obtain the necessary amount of funding to support the events. In addition, ICB also hosts their own events to encourage students' participation and involvement among international as well as non-international students to help promote international understanding and cultural awareness in Cornell. Some of the events that we have organized in the past include the International Food Tasting, International Festival, International Flag Painting, and the Media World Cup. All of these events have drawn many people to participate, and is one of the most popular events among the international students as well as non-international students. So currently this year we'll be requesting for $1.46 per student, and it will be an increase of about 15 cents from the past, which is $1.30. And we feel that this increase should be justifiable given the current given inflation and just price increase over the last 2 years. Also, our aim for the next 2 years is to increase the number of international groups that we'll be funding. So currently last year we funded 63 groups, and next year we hope to fund 65 and 68 and 73 in our projections that we use.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's hold the applause till the end of question time. Do you have any questions for the International Student Program Board? Yes, Preston.
So groups that you're planning to fund in the future, are they already exist on campus?
Other
questions,
sorry?
Do the groups you're planning to extend funding to already exist on campus, or are they new groups?
Yeah, there are currently 276 international groups on campus. So So we have only managed to reach out to about 27-30% of these groups, so we hope to increase this number. So like, these groups already exist in Cornell.
Just one more question, yes?
Were you able last year, what percent of the groups applying for funding your fund?
We funded about 95% of all the groups.
Okay, great. Okay, last question.
Well, at the same time, we'd want to fund it loosely because we want to make sure the event is really a good event and they'll not use the money in a very lavish manner. So at the same time, we hope to fund all the groups that apply to us, but we also want to be cautious with our spending.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the last Byline funded group that we'll be presenting is EMS. I also want to add that we will not have time for the election today. I'm sorry about that. That will have to happen on November 2nd.
Hi, my name is Andy Lazar. I'm Director of Operations for Cornell EMS.
Hi, my name is Tiffany Chang, and I am the Finance Officer for Cornell EMS.
So Cornell EMS is a first response emergency medical service squad that covers all 911 calls on campus, as well as provides CPR, basic first aid classes to the community, 911 service to all members of the community 24 hours a day, 7 days a week throughout the academic year. We also provide event coverage for special requests. We are an organization that our mission is based solely is focused on two categories, both community and training. And under the community, we do everything we can to make sure that the Cornell community as a whole is getting the best medical treatment in a time of emergency that is possible. We have a dedicated crew, as I said, 24 hours a day, and we educate the community with CPR. Training, we offer opportunities for students that are eager in the community to get involved in patient care, and we're able to train them throughout the entire academic year. So just some statistics about what CU EMS does. We treat approximately 600 patients every year. This past year was 570, and we are scheduled to go way above that. We teach 120 members or more of the Cornell community CPR and first aid. We conduct over 170 training exercises, over 50 hours of internal continuing medical education. We act as a security blanket to the area because we're able to provide the most number of EMTs, which are emergency medical technicians, as well as the most amount of emergency medical supplies in one unit in the entire county. We allow over 80 members of the community to give back in a consistent and irreplaceable way by volunteering their time. We hold many public education initiatives as possible, and members in our agency volunteer range from 50 hours a semester to 50 hours a week. Some of the reasons for the increase in our budget are due to equipment and medications. Because our call volume has increased, the last time we applied, we had 480 calls throughout the year. This last year, as I said, we were at 570, and this year we are already at about 455. So by the end of December, we should be way above 600. Vehicle maintenance, we now have two vehicles, so we're able to provide better care throughout our in-service hours. We're able to put multiple crews in service during times of high quantity people on campus to make sure that everybody at Cornell is getting the best care possible in the fastest amount of time. We, due to state mandates, we've had to change the way we document our calls by switching to electronic medical records, which costs extra money. Also, we, due to a generous donation, we're able to start a bike program, which allows us to get to patients at certain events in a much easier and faster manner. So we also need to fund that. We were able to reduce budgets in administrative and community education. However, at the same time, we were able to keep those two departments, those two areas doing as much as they have been. We've just been more efficient with our spending. So we've internalized the production of identification cards, and we've made the budget for instructors more efficient by using their time more efficiently. So we've increased classes to the Joplin School and the Sloan program, which have gone over very well. And each year, with our own membership, we've had members from the Sloan program, veterinary medicine, as well as engineering master's and PhD students as members of our squad, among other focuses as well. So.
So this application cycle, we are requesting $1.77. Last application cycle, we requested $1.30, so this is a 47-cent increase. And the main reason for this increase, as you said, is because of a larger call volume and because we are now providing a second truck to be in service for certain events. We have asked each of our executive board members to look through their budgets and to take anything out that isn't needed. So we are operating very efficiently right now, and we're still providing the same quality of care, just on a more efficient manner.
Are there any questions for Anna? Yes.
As an RA in undergrad, I'm aware that many undergrad students have taken advantage of medical emergency protocol, which has led to a larger number of responses. Is there a similar, if not larger, request from the SA?
Yeah.
We requested and received $3.84, mm-hmm. and that was a 48-cent increase. So it's the same proportion.
Are there any other questions? Okay.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the House tonight that is a field representative, a designated field representative, elected or appointed from your field, that would like to run to be a voting member on the GPS, on the GPS there now, at the time? Anyone from an engineering field? Yep.
Yeah.
State your name, please. Okay. Is there anyone else other than Disha? What's that? Okay. Yeah,
I'll type it in. So we have Disha. And your name, sir?
Yeah, just engineer. Yeah. Yeah.
You're not an engineer?
No. He's asking for just an engineer. Yeah. Anyone else? Okay, Disha, would you like to say 30 seconds about yourself, and I'll ask for a motion for acclamation?
Sure. Hi, I'm Disha Patel. I'm an electrical engineer. I just graduated from Purdue University. I think that was six. Okay. I always be tough if I see something not going right. I get in trouble for that a lot. That's okay. I'm used to and it's me energized. I love being involved. Don't get it.
I'll ask for motion for acclamation. So we have a second? First and second. Do we have anyone in opposition to Disha, the only person running for this position, being elected to this position? Seeing none, please congratulate Disha on joining the voting members. Turn back here.
Before you leave, just 5 minutes, please. So this book, this handbook for referring students, has been a work of about 5 years. It's a compendium that's really intended as a reference for anyone who is on the academic staff, faculty, academic advising staff, TAs, RAs. It's something that we would hope will be a reference not only in classrooms and in faculty offices, but in labs. It's basically made from two parts. The front of it is really about what's the notice and response about students engaging in difficulties. The middle is faculty advice on how to act in response to the students who might find this situation. And then the yellow page in the back is sort of a quick thumbnail of all the things you might see in a student who is distressed in a variety of ways. So I would like to ask you whether you can help us distribute this in places where we don't currently perhaps reach, that is the labs and other places around, I have 26 copies here, obviously not enough for all of you. I would like you to reach me, Ken Hubble, if you would, at KLH4, if you really can help. We think it's really important that we create a parent community on campus, one that understands that while life is wonderful at Cornell, every once in a while there are bumps in the road, and we need to be there for students who have difficulties. And it's not just for Jeanette to do this work, it's for all of us to do this work. So this book is about how all of us can help each other. While this is for faculty, next year there'll be one for staff, from everybody from custodians to dining staff. There'll be a group of materials being available for students, especially undergraduates, who want to help another. And then lastly, there'll be one for the parents of undergraduates who will want to use it as a way to interact with us on campus. They believe that students have So, while there are 26, I'm going to spread them around. You can help yourself. If you feel as though you're a TA and you want to use it, or an RA, or you want to put it in your lab, that's great. If you need more, please contact me at KLH4 by way of email, and we'll start to have it.
And we sent out, there was an electronic version.
Yes.
That was emailed out to you.
Online at the DMC's website.
And we emailed that out at, from the last meeting, so I can send it out again if needed.
While the dean is passing that out, is there anything that wants to be brought up to the open forum? If not, I would like to go ahead and adjourn this meeting.
If you said there's heat and tasting at the barn, so if you can get enough, you can maybe you can stop by on the way back to the lab and pick up some pizza.
Great. Anything else?
I'd like to just ask a question. There was the last forum regarding Reimagining Cornell, which President Schulman talked about here today, was very poorly attended by all students. I think actually graduates, there were probably more graduates there than undergraduates, but there were only 8 students there. I talked to a couple members of the undergraduate leadership and Tommy Bruce, they're starting to talk about different ideas of how we can engage students. If you have any specific ideas, let me know. One of the things we're looking at is some sort of informal discussion at the barn on a Friday afternoon during CGIS. Mm-hmm. Any other ideas are welcome. Please let me know.
Great, thank you. Well, thank you all for your attendance and for your attention throughout this meeting. Without further ado, I'd like to motion to adjourn. Thank you.
Yeah, I got it. Adjourn. Second. If you're a voting member, please see me up front.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.